going to be looking at the next couple of verses. Naomi has presented her arguments, her justifications, her reasons to her daughters-in-law as to why they should return home. And on the surface, they look pretty good. And whether she realizes it or not, they are really being put to the test. I don't know that she intentionally does this. I think in her heart she's really sincere in all her motives for having them to go back. But the Lord uses everything in our life. Everything that we say and do, whether we intend it one way or not, or another, he uses it. And the Lord's going to use this. So she's presented all her reasons to them, and we see in verse 14 their response, their reaction to all these reasons that she's given them for why they need to go back and why they shouldn't go on with her. So in verse 14, it says, and they lifted up their voice. Do you notice that's not plural? It doesn't say their voices. They lifted up their voice. So in their reaction, in their response, there's this real unity here. They lifted up their voice and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And she said, behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. So we find here the time to decide has arrived for these two women. And you kind of see similarities and you see differences. They wept and they lifted up their voice and wept again. They both wept at Naomi's words. And it's as though it's one voice, because they both love Naomi. And they both are expressing their grief at the idea of leaving Naomi. And they're both united in their grief, but they're separated by their convictions. They're united in their grief, but there's going to be something that's separating them. Both women, I think, are very sincere in their love, and they're very sincere in their grief, but there's still a difference that you see in these two women. I think the love that each has for Naomi is a different love. And I think the grief that each has at the parting from Naomi is a different grief. One will go away and one will go on. So obviously, yes, they both love her, and yes, they're both grieving, but there's something different about their love and their grief. One of the commentators said, an onlooker is not able to discover the difference between Orpah and Ruth thus far. So far, you don't see any difference between them. The crisis has come. Both have made professions. You know, both have said in verse 10, surely we will return with thee. They made a profession. So they both made professions. Here, the difference between the two is made apparent. We learn, and then he pointed out two things I thought was good. He says, we learn that it is possible to go a long way towards Christianity and yet not be a Christian. To be born, educated, and dwell in a Christian household, these are great blessings, but do not constitute or make us a Christian. It will not do to be almost. We must be altogether decided for Christ. The cup that is almost sound will not hold water. The ship that is almost whole will not weather the storm. Feelings and sentiment and profession are all good if they spring from a living faith in Jesus Christ. But without this, they're worthless. You know, Orpah's almost, but not completely. We don't know how many years she spent in that household going through the motions of family worship with that family, and how much of it was superficial and how much of it was genuine. As long as she was there with them and they were doing that, she went along with it. But that still isn't the reality of it. And then he says, we learn that it is possible to even deceive ourselves and to think that all is right when in truth all is wrong with our souls. Orpah wasn't a conscious hypocrite. she meant what she did when she became a proselyte. You know, she probably was sincere when she decided to marry her husband, and knowing that if she married him that she would have to accept his God and worship, that he would definitely not compromise. So she made the compromise so that consciously she wasn't hypocritical. She did not deliberately act apart. Feeling and sentiment, a love for her husband, blinded her eyes. Love to God, which she had thought supreme in her heart, was secondary, became secondary to her love for Moab. So he says here that there was this love for the God, which should have been supreme in her heart, but really it was secondary to her love of Moab. She loved Moab more, which is what you're going to see in her decision. And this often is true with men. They are not hypocrites, they are self-deceivers. Education and circumstances, the force of the things around them influence them, and they produce an emotional religion which they mistake for godliness. And I thought that was a really good point, that somebody by the name of Aubrey Price wrote that. And I thought, a lot of people have an emotional religion. There's this emotional moment where it looks like it's real. And then when the emotions cool down and things settle down, then you start to go back to the way you were. So we find the difference here seen in what Orpha does, because it says they both lifted up their voice and they both wept, but Orpha's going to do one thing and Ruth is going to do another. Orpha kissed her mother-in-law and Ruth clung to her, clave to her. Are those not two different things? She kisses her mother-in-law. Now to me this is it shows that she loves her mother-in-law. She kissed her. But she loved her mother-in-law, but she didn't really love her mother-in-law's God. And while living with him, she may have worshipped with him, but, you know, was it really real? I thought about this, and I thought, the kiss shows her love and her affection for Naomi, which is real, but her love for Naomi's God was only superficial. It was not enough to cause her to leave everything behind. I mean, I love Naomi, but I don't love Naomi enough to leave everything behind, because if I really love Naomi in the way that I should, I'm going to have to love her God also, because that's what really means a lot to Naomi. So it's not just enough to love Naomi, she has to love Naomi's God. And her love for Naomi may have been sincere, but I think her love for Naomi's God was superficial. And I thought, people can go through the motions of worship and fellowship and still not lay hold of the reality of what it really should be in their own lives. I think her heart was stirred up at first. You know, maybe she'd never heard about the one true and living God, and oh, this is really wonderful. I've never thought about an invisible God that, you know, you can't see, and that is so totally different from all these other gods that I've been worshiping. And so she may have been really stirred up by the difference in that religion compared to her religion. And her husband may have had a great influence on her. I'm going to do this because I love my husband and because he loves this God, and that's how he worships. But I think that she's a little bit like, I turn over to Mark chapter 4 and look at verse 16 and 17. And you see kind of a reaction here in the parable that Jesus taught, and later on we'll go into this a little bit more, but I wanted to read two verses here in Mark chapter 4, and looking at verses 16 and 17. And Jesus has presented this parable of the sower that's sown the seed and that has fallen by the wayside, and of course there's the enemy that comes and takes up that seed. But he uses this example here in verse 16, and these are they likewise which are sown on stony ground, who when they have heard the word immediately receive it with gladness. And I think, you know, she may have heard about the God of Israel and for a short time been happy about it, glad about it, excited about it. But they have no root in themselves, and so endure but for a time. And so she endured but for a time. for as long as her husband was alive. When he died, and she no longer had his influence in her life, and when Naomi was going to leave, and there would no longer be that influence in her life, then we find that there is this change of heart. She endured but for a time, and afterward, when affliction or persecution ariseth for the word's sake, immediately they are offended. Well, if she goes all the way with Naomi, she's going to suffer affliction. And what will her family say? And what will her friends say? And is she ready to face a time apart from the land of Moab and that nationality that she is so proud of? So we find here that she kisses her goodbye, which shows her affection, but also that kiss is a kiss of parting. It's a farewell kiss. It's not just, oh, I love you, Naomi. It's goodbye, Naomi. Farewell, Naomi. It's a farewell kiss. And I wanted us to look at two examples in the Bible of how this is used. And the first is in Genesis 31 and verse 55. So if you go to Genesis 31, and here we have the account of Jacob, who has been told by the Lord that he needs to return home, and he is going to return home. And we have the account of his father-in-law. And so we find here in Genesis 31, looking at, let's see, I'm going to start a little earlier. We'll go back to verse 41, but we're going to read down to verse 55. And Jacob actually has left without telling his father-in-law, and his father-in-law has followed him, and Jacob has finally confronted him with one of the reasons that he's leaving. And he says in verse 41 in Genesis 31, "Thus have I been 20 years in thy house, and I served thee 14 years for thy two daughters and 6 years for thy cattle, and thou hast changed my wages 10 times. Except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away now empty. God hath seen mine affliction and labor of my hands, and rebuked thee yesternight." And Laban answered and said unto Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and these cattle are my cattle, and all that thou seest is mine. What can I do this day unto thee, these my daughters, or unto their children which they have not borne? Now therefore come thou, let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee." And Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. And Jacob said unto his brethren, "Gather these stones that they," and they took stones and made a heap, and they did eat there upon the heap. And Laban called it Jagar-Sahadutha, but Jacob called it what? Galeed, or Gilead, which means a heap of witness. Both of those names mean the same thing. They mean a heap of witness. Those stones were heaped up, and they became a witness of the covenant they were going to make. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between me and thee this day." Therefore was the name of it called Galeed. And Mizpah, which means watchtower, for he said, "The Lord watch between me and thee when we are absent one from another. If thou shalt afflict my daughters, or if thou shalt take other wives beside my daughters, no man is with us. God is witness betwixt me and thee." And Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, and behold this pillar, which I have cast betwixt me and thee. This heap is a witness, and this pillar be witness, that I will not pass over this heap to thee, and that thou shalt not pass over this heap and this pillar unto me for harm." So they aren't going to hurt each other. "The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the God of their father judge betwixt us, and Jacob swear by the fear of his father Isaac." Isn't that interesting? I'd never really noticed before that He swears by the fear of his father Isaac. Second time it says that. Then Jacob offered sacrifice upon the mount and called his brethren to eat bread, and they did eat bread and tarried all night in the mount. And early in the morning Laban rose up and, what? Kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. And Laban departed and returned unto his place. You know, there it's a kiss. It's a final parting. I'm not going to see you again. It's a way of saying goodbye, a permanent goodbye. And what did Orpah do? She kissed her mother-in-law. She said goodbye to her. She was returning home, and she knew that Naomi was going home. So they were going two opposite directions, and she knew, I'll never see her again. So this is goodbye. And then the other example I thought, which was really good, is in 1 Kings chapter 19. If you would turn over to 1 Kings chapter 19, and here we find Elijah commissioning by the word of the Lord, Elijah, calling him to come along with him and to be a prophet. And so in 1 Kings 19, looking at verse 19, the Lord has sent Elijah with this mission. And verse 19 says, so Elijah departed thence and found Elijah the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. Now, you know, he doesn't say anything, and yet Elisha knows immediately what this means. He knows that this is a prophet of God, and he obviously knows that the minute he casts his mantle upon him, this is a call to follow him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee. And he said unto him, go back again, for what have I done to thee? Now, one of the ways that you can look at this is, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee. And he said unto him, go back again. And one of the renderings says in brackets, testing him. Go back again. It's a test. For what have I done to thee? Settle it for yourself. In other words, I'm not forcing you to do this. I'm not dragging you against your will after me. Go back. If you want to go back, go back. And settle all the matter for yourself. If you really want to come, come. If you don't want to come, stay. Go and the Jewish Bible says, go but return because of what I have done to you. And the Jewish Bible says, go back but return because of what I've done to you. In other words, I've called you, but you go ahead, go back and say goodbye to your father and your mother. And so verse 21 says, and he returned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave them unto the people, and they did eat. And then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered unto him. So that, you know, he says, I want to kiss my father and mother goodbye. Well, he did. He went back. He said, I'll follow you, but I need to tell my mom and dad goodbye because I'm not going to see them. I don't know when I will ever see them again. I don't know where you'll be going and how long that I'll be gone. So he gave them a kiss of farewell. I was looking at this, and Orpah was willing to go back. She was willing to return. She was willing to let Naomi go. In a sense, Naomi says, go back because you need to settle it for yourself. I don't want you going on if you really don't want to go on. So she presents all the reasons why she should go back. So she accepts Naomi's first justifications for returning. And I thought about, why'd she do that? I think because she wanted to go back. I think deep down, she started out following Naomi because Ruth made that decision to go, and this is probably what we should be doing. And Naomi doesn't let him get very far before she stops him, and she gives him the reasons why they shouldn't go on. And I think that the reason that she accepts those reasons and returns is because she really, in her heart, wanted to go back. She knew that if she really followed Naomi all the way, she would lose everything. You know, she was willing to go back. She was willing to return. She was willing to let Naomi go. She accepted Naomi's reasons for returning because in her heart all along, this is what she wanted to do. And I think Naomi knew it. I think Naomi had this insight. She knew that if she followed Naomi all the way, she'd have to give up everything. And I thought about how many of God's people go on for a while in the things of the Lord because they really get excited when they hear, say, the bridal truth. And it stirs their heart, and they really get excited about it, and they go on in the things of the Lord for a while and say they want to win Christ and have him as their bridegroom. And then they start to see how hard the way is. And maybe their family and their friends or others that are they've known in the past say, you know, do you really want to do this? Do you realize what you're going to give up? And they start to look at what they've let go of, and they miss those things that they've let go of. And so they turn back. But they don't turn back until sometimes an opportunity presents itself, until somebody gives them an excuse, or somebody gives them a reason, or somebody gives them a way to justify the decision that they've already made in their heart so they don't feel guilty anymore. And a lot of people do that. They go on for a while, and then they're still going on, but their heart's just not in it. You know, they're going because, well, this is the way I started, and everybody else is going, and then if there's an opportunity that presents itself where you can justify it, then you feel better about going back. And a lot of people do that. And this is what Orpha did. She had something to justify. Well, see, Naomi told me that, you know, I can't get married and I can't ever have any children and there's really nothing for me in that land, so of course I should go back. And so I think she felt pretty good about going back. She didn't feel guilty and sad about it and like she was missing out on anything. And so you have those two groups of people. Ruth's not going to be like that. Ruth is going to say, no, I don't want to go back. You know, Jesus, turn over to Matthew 19 and look at verse 21 because Jesus really looks deep into the heart of individuals that start out making a profession of, oh, yes, I want to follow you, Lord. And he shows them what is really in their heart. And not only does he show them what's really in their heart, when they see what he says, they use that as a justification for going back. And remember in Matthew 19, there was this young man that came to Jesus and basically said, Lord, I want to follow you everywhere. And then he asks this question, what can I do to really have eternal life? And Jesus says, basically, well, you need to do what the law says you should do. And he says, well, I've done all that. You know, I feel justified. I've done everything that I should do. So, you know, what more do I need to do? And so Jesus really knows exactly what it is that's in his heart. And in Matthew 19:21, Jesus said unto him, if thou wilt be perfect, go and sell that all that thou hast, and give to the poor. And thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. He's really saying, give up everything that you have, and that's what you're going to have to do to follow me. Sell everything, and give it to people that don't have anything, and then follow me who has nothing. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. And I looked at that, and Jesus saw that the love of possessions could really be a hindrance to going all the way. And I think that Orpha knew that, you know, if I go to Ruth, times are going to be tough. We're widows. We're all three of us widows. And who's going to provide for us? If I go back to Moab, I've got family and friends and an opportunity maybe to find another husband and maybe another rich husband. And I can go back to the life that I really like. And so there is this love of possessions that I think hinders from a wholehearted commitment. Even Paul saw that there was this love of the world that could hinder from wholehearted commitment, because at the end of his life in 2 Timothy 4, 10, Paul says, "For Demas hath forsaken me, having loved what? This present world. And is departed unto Thessalonica." So there was somebody that went back. And he went back and it didn't bother him. And he went back from going all the way because he loved something more. He loved the world more. The young man that wanted to follow Jesus loved his possessions more. Demas loved the world more. In a sense, if you don't love the Lord more than all these things, it's hard to go on and be really content and face whatever it is that lies ahead of you, not knowing what it would be. You know, Orpha didn't have this wholehearted attitude or this wholehearted commitment. In other words, she wasn't willing to lose it all. But Ruth, whereas Orpha says, "Oh, I love you, Naomi. Goodbye, Naomi." Gives her a kiss. "I know I'm not going to see you again." And I think she left and her heart was not heavy. It was happy. Ruth, you see the difference in her reaction here. Whereas they start out both lifting up their voices as one voice and weeping at the words of Naomi, after that their reactions are different. And it says, Ruth clave unto Naomi. And that means she clung to Naomi. She wouldn't let her go. The word clave, you know, means to cling to hold on to. It means to hold fast to, abide fast. In other words, she held on to her. And have you ever hugged somebody and they just held on to you so tight you couldn't get loose because they didn't want to let you go? Because they just needed you so much? And she hugged Naomi and held on to her, and she held her so tight she wouldn't let her go. What do you think Naomi's heart felt like to feel that response? "I don't want to leave you." It also means, besides to cling to or just to hold fast to, it means to follow closely after. She'd already followed closely after her in her heart. Now she was going to do it in her feet. With her body. Her body was going to follow her heart the rest of the way. So it means to follow closely after. It also is translated as something else. And so turn over to Psalm 68 and look at verse 8. And here you see this word cleave or clave to translated in an entirely different way, but it's exactly what it means here in Ruth. So in Psalm 63:8, is that right? And I just love this because I never before realized that this is the same word. So Psalm 63:8 says, "My soul followeth hard after thee." That's the same word that Ruth uses here, that's used in connection with Ruth, but Ruth clave unto her. One of the translations for it is to follow hard after thee. So, "My soul followeth hard after thee. Thy right hand upholdeth me." And that's really what Ruth did here when she clung to her mother-in-law. She said, "My soul is going to follow hard after thee." It's already done it. That's the purpose of heart. The other definition, it means to cling to abide fast to follow close after. And the other definition for to clave unto her means to be joined together with. And actually, you know, the moment that she holds tight to her, and they will both of them go together on that journey together, she's joined her self with Naomi, so that I'm joining myself with you now, Naomi, and I'm joining myself with your God, and I'm joining myself with your people, and I'm joining myself together with whatever happens when we get there, the hard times and the good times. if there are hardships and adversity, if we go hungry, I've joined myself to that fate. If there are blessings that will come forth from this, I've joined myself to that. So she's joined herself together with Naomi and Naomi's people and Naomi's God and all the blessings ultimately that will come forth from that decision that she makes. And so now we see the difference between Naomi and between Ruth and her sister Orpha. Both love Naomi, but Ruth loves her more with a different type of love. Can you love people with different types of love? Can you love them because, well, I love them because they're family, I can't help it, I'm stuck with them, family's family. And then can you have somebody just tug at your heartstrings and they just crawl right into your heart and it's like they are so close to you that you can't imagine life without them? And that's the way she felt with Naomi. She doesn't want to let go and she will not let go. And she doesn't want to go back and she will not go back. And the next words that she will, in other words, it's going to take a lot more to persuade Ruth to go back. And I think Naomi's run out of arguments. I don't think she has anything else that she can present unto her to persuade her to go back. And it's going to take more than what she's already said to get her to go back. God has drawn her away from her past life. And she doesn't realize it yet, but he's going to draw her into a glorious future. And it will take more than what Naomi has said to cause her to change her love or her commitment that she has set before us here as an example. In the end, Ruth's response is going to really explain all the meanings of that word clay, because she does literally cling to Naomi, hold on to her. And she does, in a sense, by doing that, say, I'm going to abide fast by you no matter what happens. She'll say, your God is my God. Your people are my people, whatever happens. And when we get to the next chapter, we're going to find out times are tough when they start out, because she's got to go out into the field and glean to get food to eat, because they're the poorest of the poor. But she said, I'm going to cling to you, literally, and I'm going to hold fast to you no matter what happens, and I'm going to follow close after you and not let you out of my sight. And I'm willing to be joined together with you, and your fate will be my fate. And so it's a permanent commitment. Once she says this, there's no going back. And ultimately, when she says, I'm going to be joined together with you, she doesn't know it, but there's somebody else the Lord is going to join her together with. And it's a man by the name of Boaz. So that first step of commitment leads to a greater step of commitment. She's willing at all costs to share all of Naomi's experiences, all of her hardships, all of her suffering, all of her sorrow. She's willing to share Naomi's faith, and as Naomi is willing to lay hold of God's promises, she's willing to lay hold of God's promises. And though it doesn't look much like Naomi's doing that now, when Naomi sees that there's an opportunity for Ruth to lay hold of something, her instructions to Naomi in the following chapters are really laying hold of God's promises. So her faith is stirred by Ruth. Ruth is going to spark Naomi's faith, which is kind of at a low place right here. And the Lord's going to present a circumstance that will cause Naomi to say, oh, this is God's promise. By faith, I'm going to lay hold of this for my daughter-in-law. So she's going to lay hold of the blessings and provision that are promised by the Lord. And I just thought, how wonderful if we cleave unto these individuals that are testimonies of faith in our lives. If we hold fast to them and let their faith stir us and enable us to go on. Now, there were only a few out of all of those that heard Paul at Athens when Paul preached that great sermon at Mars Hill. There were only a few people out of the huge crowd that was probably there that actually were willing to cleave unto him. And it says over in Acts 17:32 that when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, well, some of them mocked. And some of the others said, well, we'll hear you again. We'll hear about this another time. But it says, certain men clave unto him and believed. It says that in Acts 17:34. There were men that clave or clung to the Apostle Paul and believed. They followed closely after Paul. They abided fast with the Apostle Paul. They were willing to be joined together with the Apostle Paul, and he was not a popular guy. So that there is this cleaving unto that happens, but usually it's the minority and not the majority. Brother Art Eggers says, both women heard Naomi, but only one heard God's voice. I like that. You know, they both heard Naomi, but through Naomi, silently, God was speaking. And Brother Art Eggers says, only one of them heard God's voice. Ruth made her decision to stay with Naomi no matter what. Ruth was willing to suffer or make any changes that were required of her. They dwelled there for about 10 years with Naomi, and both should have known God's ways by that time. On what should we base our decisions? We find a good formula in, and whatsoever ye do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus. So Brother Art quotes Colossians 3:17. If you want to know what you should use as a criteria for deciding, do it in the name of the Lord Jesus. Would Jesus do this? Would he go here? Would he say this? Would he fellowship this? And then I found a really good comment here from Brother Weiserby, and he kind of uses an experience from Pilgrim's Progress and brings it right alongside of Ruth and Naomi, Ruth and Orpha following Naomi. And so he says, when Christian set out from the city of destruction, he too, for a short part of his journey, was attended by two companions. Naomi sets out on her journey, and how many accompany her? Two, Ruth and Orpha. The first, indeed, obstinate, only went with him in order to try and bring him back to what he considered wiser courses, but the other, pliable, was absolutely sincere in his desire to reach the celestial city. And you kind of see here in Orpha, well, she starts out sincere because she doesn't start out to dissuade Naomi. And so he goes on and says, Pliable says, I intend to go along with this good man, he said, and cast in my lot with him. Orpha joined with Ruth and declared, surely I will return with the end of thy people. So Orpha is saying a little bit like Pliable, well, I'm going to go along and cast my lot in with him. Just like Pliable said to Christian. She says, I will return with thee to thy people. Yet as we know, when the pilgrims being heedless fell under the slough of despondency, poor Pliable, his virtuous intentions notwithstanding, gave a desperate struggle or two and got out of the mire, and on that side of the slough went, which was next to his own house. So when he finally climbed out of the mire, oh gosh, my house is right over there. I think I'll just head on home. He went on home. And so he went away, and Christian saw him no more. He started out with him, and he didn't go along very far. So he says, there are one or two particulars in which the behavior of Orpha was not unlike that of well-meaning Pliable. And I hadn't really thought about the similarity. To begin with, there can be no question but that she had a sincere affection for Naomi, and Pliable had an affection for Christian, and would genuinely have liked to spend the remainder of her days in her society. But the attachment was purely personal, and in all such friendships there is a breaking point, a limit to the extent to which others are prepared to follow us. You know, they'll only go so far just because they like us. For it is only us whom they are following, and our path may lead us into circumstances more trying than they are prepared to undergo, whose hearts are not buoyed up by the hope that animates our own. So you can't follow somebody just because you like that person. They can draw you, but eventually it's got, your following them has to be based upon your own convictions. And another somewhat sad reflection respecting the history of Orpha springs from the fact that she actually started for the better land and indeed went some considerable way on the journey. The thought of those fellow travelers of ours who set out so cheerily with us and yet failed after all to persevere is one of the saddest that comes to our memory when we review our pilgrimage. We call to mind their fervor and their enthusiasm and their interest. We shall never forget how our hearts sank within us when they announced their intention of turning back. And in the case of Orpha, our feelings are the more regretful because we bear in mind that she was full of the best possible resolutions of going further still. Surely, she said, no less earnestly than Ruth herself, surely we will return with thee unto thy people. But as we have already noticed, the desire in her mind was to be, as she put it, with thee. You notice that? Surely we will return with thee. Where's God in this? There has to be that commitment to God to go all the way, not just with you. It was a personal element in her relation to Naomi which constituted the weakness of her position. It was on this rock that her frail vessel was wrecked at last. Further, if Orpha's decision pains us, can we remain unmoved at Orpha's tears? She is quite clear in her own mind that she can go no further. She will leave a portion of her heart behind her when she says farewell to Naomi. She lifted up her voice and wept. She lifted up her voice and wept again. Alas for the impotence of tears. The question for each to ask himself is not, what have I felt, but what have I done? Orpha loved Naomi dearly and wept bitterly at the prospect of parting from her, but returned to her people and her gods nevertheless. And I thought, there's kind of a similarity there. And we can look back on our own life and think about how many people started out with us and how many people went back after a period of time. And then the last thought I wanted you to think about is the statement that Ruth makes. Ruth clings unto Naomi. And I thought about this also in type is kind of a picture of what the Gentiles will do in the millennium. Because it says that in Zechariah 8:23, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold of all languages of the nations, even shall they take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. And you kind of have that picture in the last days. There is this drawing power that the Jew will have to bring the Gentile nations into that knowledge of God. And it says, they take hold of the skirt of him. They cling to them. They hold fast to him. And they say, we will go with you, which is what Ruth says. We will go with you. And so you see that similarity there also. That's Zechariah 8:23. I just thought that's so similar to what Ruth is doing here in type. So we find here two women that on the surface their reaction looks the same, but as soon as they open up their mouth and make a decision, one kisses Naomi goodbye and the other holds fast to her and won't let her go. Praise the Lord. And that's what I want to do is hold fast to and not let go of these wonderful promises.